Hey, do you want to be like me and make podcasts that everyone loves? Yeah, you do. But chances are, you don't want to spend a bunch of money doing it. No worries. A solution exists. Spotify's got a platform that lets you make podcasts super easy, then distribute those podcasts everywhere, and you can even earn money doing it. All in one place for free. It's called Spotify for Podcasters, and here's how it works. Spotify for Podcasters lets you record and edit podcasts right from your phone or computer. So no matter what your setup is like, you can start creating today. Then you can distribute your podcast to Spotify and everywhere else podcasts are heard. Also, you can earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions. I'm speaking from experience when I say that all those additional features like video podcasts, Q&As, polls, those are things you won't find for cheap elsewhere. But with Spotify for Podcasters, it's all totally free, no catch. I highly recommend you give it a try. Download the Spotify for Podcasters app or go to www.spotify.com/podcasters to get started. Thanks. We love you. Everybody, welcome to Pretty Scary.
Pretty Scary, boo.
Carrie? Oh, wow.
Yeah, she's icing us out again.
Still no words.
No.
Well, thank you for joining us. Either way, even though she's not going to talk.
She's flipping me off. It's fine.
That's Carrie.
Good old Carrie.
But we do have a guest. Caitlin, introduce our guest.
Okay.
This is so exciting.
So today we have in our really glamorous studio.
The disco studio.
In the tower that we are now looking down
on Pop's Tower.
Yeah, on Pop's Tower in Burbank, California.
Right.
Today we have the director of a huge new true crime documentary called Abducted in Plain Sight. I know if you haven't seen it yet, you've at least heard about it or seen some articles about it.
It's blowing up,
and I am so excited to introduce Skye Borgman. How are you?
I am so excited to be here. Thank you so much for asking me to be on this podcast. I can't wait to talk to you both.
These are your people. Trust me. This is their shit. So I have so many questions. Can I just go?
Yeah, well, I mean, we should let Skye. Do you want to give some people the background on some people? Just not everyone listening, just some people.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, Adam, you're right.
Background on Abducted in Plain Sight for people who haven't.
The last time I was this excited on the show was when we interviewed that author who knew all about the LA true crime stuff from the 50s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
She had Black Dahlia facts.
Oh, awesome.
And my head exploded. I'm back now.
But yeah, Abducted in Plain Sight, it's such a great documentary. I watched it. I was just randomly scrolling through documentaries on Amazon, and I actually rented it.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, before it was on Netflix, because I saw the description and was like, oh my God.
Well, I remember when we were emailing and you were like, I think I've watched this. I'm like, really? Have you watched it? It's not real. I mean, it's kind of out, but it's not really out.
Yeah, but
yeah, that's it.
We were emailing pre-explosion of your movie.
Right.
It was like the very, and by the time that I kind of figured out what was going on, I was like, oh, this is a really big documentary for the true crime world. So my audience will have seen it. Now we're in a whole other stratosphere with this thing.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mention that because it was a whole different stratosphere for me about 6 months ago because I started really sort of focusing on the true crime audiences and trying to get the film in front of them because we were on the festival circuit. But it's such a weird thing because there aren't that many true crime film festivals. So getting it out in front of true crime people is not the easiest thing in the world to
do. Are there any true crime film festivals?
Yeah, so Toronto,
we
I know.
We have to go.
Yes. Yeah.
Toronto True Crime Film Festival, which had its first festival last year, and we were the opening night film.
Oh, wow.
And Lisa Gallagher, who is amazing, she runs the whole thing. It's a great film festival. And I think I was saying, is there any other film festival for true crime enthusiasts? And she was like, there's one other one in New York. And I think now, because the desire to watch these films is so giant, I think more people are getting onto it and kind of doing sort of dual festivals where they're doing kind of horror film festivals and true crime film festivals.
I also think that, I mean, if we really want to talk about the, there have always been true crime documentaries.
Always.
It's just now we're retroactively naming them true crime. But
yes.
Really what they are is journalism.
Right.
So, I mean, like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's just that I feel like we're living in such a fractured time where we're just trying to categorize everything right now, which in this case has been great, especially for the, you know, the wheelhouse that the three of us have been in. But
yeah. Well, do you think, I mean, it feels like there's been an explosion in the last few years, really, of true crime.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
I think because of podcasts.
I think Serial.
I think so, too. Totally.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, so I started watching true crime. I was homesick a lot.
Yeah.
You know, very Spielberg of me. And, you know, it started with Unsolved Mysteries, and then Snapped, I think, was the first show that elevated from, okay, we've got some unsolved murders and aliens, and this is like, no, we know exactly who killed these people, and now we have a theme. So now this is what this is. And then that was on Oxygen. And from that show, you kind of started to see this cross-pollinization between that, and then A&E was an early adopter of true crime.
Yeah.
But they were, I would say that they really led the journalist quality with the true crime stuff, because they had City Confidential, Cold Case Files, I think is what it was called. And it was like, you know, Stacey Keach doing the voices
and all of
that stuff, which was so great. And then I think the third point of this triangle is like the Datelines in the 2020s.
Forensic Files, too.
Forensic Files was OG.
Yeah.
Where did that even air on? Originally.
I don't know, because I mean now it's like always on HLN, always.
Yeah.
Right.
Like
yeah.
It's just, or like any hotel room you go
right,
to,
yeah.
Forensic Files is playing. You're like, okay, cool. You know,
the narrator of Forensic Files was the best true crime narrator of all time.
He's up there with Keith Morrison, I think.
And I wanted, when I started working at Cracked back in 2011, I was like, finally, I have a job where I'm going to be able to reach out to that guy and do something with him. And then he died a day later or something.
I hope they were able to find out why.
They still haven't solved this
guy. Oh, man. I love watching the old episodes of Forensic Files because it's like, criminologists use cutting edge technology, and it's like that first Mac, you know,
right?
I like DOS cards, and you know,
I like watching them and just kind of trying to figure out which ones they just coerced confessions in.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you didn't have that evidence. Get out of
here.
Yeah,
no. But yeah, so I think back to your original question. I think it was true crime podcast because suddenly everybody started looking around at each other and going like, "Wait, you like this stuff too?" You know, it's not just trashy TV, you know. And that's really how White Wine True Crime got started, because Carrie and I were doing a show and we were both drinking white wine, and Carrie made some flippant comment about Luminol,
right?
And
right.
I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah. Well, I also think podcasts really gave us kind of the first opportunity to dig really deeply into something. You know, you've got 20 hours to
Absolutely.
Put some content out there, and it wasn't just a 90-minute documentary or a one-hour show that we're watching. You know, you could really dive deep into so many different facets of it.
Yeah, and I think also just with the cross-stream of podcasts and social media.
Oh, yeah.
So social media is really the biggest vehicle for why true crime became a thing.
Because
we've been fascinated, I've said this a million times, like, we've been fascinated by, especially murder, since it's literally the second story in the Bible.
Yeah.
Like, we've been into this for a while now. And, you know, Jack the Ripper was a phenomenon, you know. So, but it's a good segue, because your documentary is not about murder.
No.
It's a topic that I would, I mean, I'll get into this a little bit more later. I credit the true crime wave for our ability to have these conversations now.
Oh, I agree with you completely.
How did you decide, like, what made you decide to cover this story?
Yeah.
Like, where did you first encounter
this
story?
Yeah, my first encounter was really with the book that they wrote, Stolen Innocence, and they had self-published this book in the early 2000s, and friend of mine, Stephanie Toby, who's one of the producers on the film, she and Jan had a mutual friend. And so Jan, it was when Ariel Castro and the girls escaped from Ariel Castro, and it was over the media. And Stephanie was like, her brain was exploding. And she was like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. This is crazy, crazy, crazy. And she talked to her friend and she's like, oh, you think that story's crazy? You should read this. Handed Stephanie the book, and Stephanie read it and was like, holy cow, like, how does this happen?
Right.
And so the mutual friend introduced the two of them, and Steph hadn't really worked on a documentary before, so she and I knew each other from working on other projects before, and she came to me and said, was this something you'd be interested in doing? And I read the book, and I had no idea how something like this could happen. Like, the whole idea of two kidnappings with the same guy, I was like, the pieces just didn't line up at all. And so I think that's really what got me the most interested in this story, was figuring out how something like this could happen.
So your background is primarily you were a DP.
Yes.
For specifically, and this is something that I love, that I found out after you and I connected, true crime reenactments. That was like a strength of yours, or is a strength of yours, rather.
Yeah.
Which shines in this movie specifically.
Thanks.
Oh, yeah.
I love hearing that because, I mean, I make my living for the most part as a director of photography for a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do a lot of true crime recreations, which I adore doing.
Sure.
I do a lot of documentaries, and documentaries that are more sort of, you know, socially conscious documentaries, documentaries about women and change that they're instituting in third world countries.
Wow.
And I work closely with a lot of female directors of documentaries. And so it's always been, documentaries for sure have always been my love in sort of the film genre, because, I mean, every single documentary film I've worked on has changed my life, has opened my eyes, has given me new insight to the world.
That's a strong statement.
Huge. It's huge. It's absolutely true, too. They've helped me realize who I am and how I can be a better person. I mean, they've been completely impactful on my life.
So would you say that those prior experiences helped you take a softer approach to what you, I think you, I mean, I might be being presumptuous here, but this is a very delicate family to become enmeshed in.
Yes.
So you couldn't be like some grizzled, you know, New York Times, roll your sleeves up, you know, just say it, goddammit.
Right.
You know, you can't do that with this story.
No, I don't think you can. I mean, I've said it many, many times before. I think part of our strength going in and doing this documentary was it was a team of three women,
right,
really, that went into this house and talked to these parents. And just, you know, we did dishes together and we played with the grandkids. And we communicated with them about just normal stuff and talked a little bit about what the interviews were going to be like in the coming days, but we were more just women talking to them. And it's a very female household, you know. It's
It is.
Three daughters, a mom and Bob, and it's just always had so much female energy that I think those two energies really matched in a great way.
I mean, it comes through. There's a level, I mean, you can especially, I feel like the confessionals with Bob specifically, you can really see him make the decision to say the thing he's going to say and then say it, which I think in documentary filmmaking is such a cool thing to be able to capture. Because, you know, sometimes it's like, well, you know, you watch these true crime documentaries and people are so traumatized that, not that you want them to say anything more than they'd be comfortable saying, but it's very obvious there's a, you know, still waters run deep kind of a thing.
Right.
And in this case, the things that they say are what make your documentary so explosive. You know, they're not just like narration and then cutaway, reaction, more narration.
Yeah.
This is the film. The story is driven by the narration that you capture from the interviews.
Yeah. And I always think it's a really fascinating thing because I know in talking with Jan, who's an actress, and Marianne, who they have both been talking about this story in a public way for the last 10 or 15 years, less so kind of in the last 5 years, but really from the time the book came out, you know, they were talking about it very publicly. Jan was doing public speaking. And so, I mean, you guys know, you know, sort of on talking on podcasts, how things can kind of become rote sometimes where you say things and then you just, it becomes a bit of a monologue. And so that was, I think, with this film and with any film, it's always the goal and the aim is to kind of get that monologue out there, get that telling of the story, and then to kind of come in at it from different directions and kind of get a little bit beneath the surface of what they've been accustomed to talking about for the past 20 years or 10 years or however long it is, and just dig a little bit deeper. And that's, I think that's what's intriguing about making documentary films, is really sort of talking to people about things they didn't think about in a certain way.
Should we, before we get too into the details of the documentary, can you give just kind of a broad overview of what the story behind it, because it's crazy.
It's crazy.
We could just end the show with you just giving a Reader's Digest version of what happened.
I know.
Yeah. There are some events in this documentary.
Yeah.
So the story, Abducted in Plain Sight, is about a family that live in Pocatello, Idaho, and they're befriended by a fellow church member from the LDS church, and he kind of makes his way into the family and gets very strong relationships with both the mother and the father, and he's got five kids, he's married, and these two families end up spending a lot of time together, and everybody loves him. He's like the life of the party. And then he ends up kidnapping Jan once, and then another time, and then also goes off to Jackson Hole and convinces Jan that she wants to come with him, and so she goes off to Jackson Hole and manages throughout all of these escapades to basically get off with spending only 9 days in jail.
Right. And so, Jan is 12
and 14, like the second time she's 14. So, yeah, she's a little girl. He's 39 and second time is 40. He also manages in a very sort of intrinsic way to groom the entire family.
Yes.
And beyond grooming the entire family, I think he also groomed the entire community. And so when this was happening, you know, there were certainly half of the community that really believed in the Brobergs and half the community that really believed in Berchtold. And so there was this sort of divisive thing that set into play. I mean, the film also has aliens, it has motorhomes, it has arson, it has CIA.
The
alien plotline. Okay. The mission. We have to finish the mission.
Okay, so, God, we're going to start. All right, so the first question I have is about something that gets mentioned quickly, and I think it's because of just economy. Like, you know, there is the device that Berchtold uses to convince the father and mother of Jan to allow him to sleep in the bed with her. Is that A, he's been, you know, seeing a therapist for the fact that he was sexually molested by his aunt. Tells them this, which I think you do a very good job of showing how just explosive that admission alone at the time would have been. So that causes everybody to kind of set back on their heels. So they don't know what to do with this.
Right.
And then the second punch in it is that he then informs the parents that, well, I know this sounds crazy, but part of my therapy is I need to lay in bed next to a child and listen to these tapes, which he presents these tapes that the therapist gave him.
Right.
And this, you know, when you watch the documentary, you can understand why this had to be said very quickly. But that alone could be its own documentary.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
So can you expand a little bit more on that? Because I'm fascinated by this plot point.
Yeah, it was really interesting. And we actually talked to a forensic psychologist to kind of help us unpack all of this and sort of asked her, you know, what was therapy like in the 70s? Is this normal? And what we sort of came to believe, the parents and Jan never heard these tapes. Like, they were tapes that Berchtold sort of held it up and said, I need to listen to these tapes that will help me through this trauma that I went through as a child. But that they never listened to them, and they never listened to what was on them. And what the forensic psychologist believes is that if this therapist actually did give these tapes to Berchtold, we don't know that. It's what he said.
Sure.
It's what he told the Brobergs. So he may have gotten these tapes somewhere else. It seems plausible that a therapist gave him these tapes, but her thinking is that the therapist probably gave these tapes and said, you should lay in bed next to your wife and listen to these tapes. And so he, according to our forensic psychologist, sort of had gone and taken this and
interesting.
Yeah, flipped this story.
Okay.
And so he'd taken portions of this, and I think he did that quite well, actually, is taken this kind of truth and just turned it 90 degrees and made it into his own truth. And so took these tapes and laid down with Jan to listen to these pretty highly sexualized tapes.
Kind of speaking to that, one of the things that's really unsettling about this documentary to me is it's not unlike watching a documentary about like an athlete or someone who is just really, really great at their job.
Right.
Yes.
And when people hear stories like this and are like, well, how does this happen? because this guy's really great at what he's doing.
And I don't...
like he knows what he's doing, and it's really effective.
Yeah.
And it I think just sheds a lot of light on how these kind of things. You see it in Leaving Neverland too with Michael Jackson. Like he was very calculated in what he was doing to make this happen.
Well, and people who've lived a really have had the luxury of never been under the thumb of an abusive person well really can't understand the cloud that's created. I mean, even just that alone, you know, people aren't thinking straight under those circumstances.
Right.
And, you know, to that point, you know, let's talk about his relationship with the parents, because, you know, he realizes that the only way to get to the daughter is to completely manipulate the family, which you can also understand why what's mentioned in the documentary is that he's tried this. The term that that FBI agent who I will love until the day I die.
Yeah.
What's his name?
Pete Welsh.
Welsh. Oh, my God. I love him.
Yeah.
The way he phrases it is like he had tried this with two little girls in the community before. But what I heard was he had tried this with two families before.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, basically he was going to be scientific about this until he could find a family where, in his mind, he could completely encapsulate this one person as long as he could completely disengage the parents from what was going on.
Yeah.
And how he did it was incredibly predatory. And I don't know if I really want to spoil it for people that haven't seen the documentary, because there's a... You kind of want to experience
one of those
this surprise.
Documentaries, kind of. Have you seen Crazy Love?
Oh, yeah, of course.
There's a point in the middle of, like, if you've seen Crazy Love, you want to tell everyone what happens in the middle of that documentary, but you can't.
You can't.
You can't.
But,
like, you have to keep that a secret.
But what I want to talk about is the way your documentary validates the process that a predator goes into when grooming a family.
Yeah, it's interesting because throughout the whole time when I was working on the film, you know, my husband would come in and I'd be playing something on my computer and he's like, they're vampires. I'm like, what? He's like, they're vampires. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, in all the vampire shows you ever watch, a vampire has to be invited into the home.
Wow.
Oh.
And I was like, you're
Ooh,
right. I know,
chills.
I did too.
I love that. No, it's completely true. And actually, yeah, I mean, that's actually, I mean, if you think about Twilight, it's
right.
The oldest man in the world dating a 15-year-old.
Right, yeah, exactly, right?
Strong parallel. Strong parallel.
That is.
Definitely isolates her from the rest of the family.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's a whole other podcast.
I know.
So what was the question?
Wait, the difference veered off is, this is a good movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well said. Well said. My question is, why do you think it's taken so long to talk about grooming specifically? Because, like, what I find really ironic about it is that we all talk about the Catholic Church, right? Like, it's a big system. It's like something we all know.
Right.
And it's like, it's totally organized. And
right.
We all know they swat these people around.
Yeah.
So we know how incorporated something like this can be. But for some reason, when we're talking about it on a micro level, which is just as prevalent, we haven't had this conversation yet.
Yeah. It's so fascinating because I've really been thinking about this since we finished the film and we were talking about it at film festivals, which was, we had great conversations, but really since the film hit Netflix and there has been such sort of violent reactions to the parents.
Yeah.
And that's when my processing and my eyes kind of opened and I'm like, that's why we don't talk about it, because we don't want to be attacked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't want to tell how we were blindsided, how the mistakes that we made, because everybody is going to call us stupid. Everybody is going to say we messed up. Everybody is going to blame us, which is happening now with the documentary, too. People are blaming the parents.
Not just that, but and Leaving Neverland.
And Leaving Neverland.
And I have to be honest. I mean, there were moments in both documentaries where I looked at my husband and was like, they've lost me now. I don't understand this part. But one of the things that I find... Back to my boy Pete. I love Pete.
I know.
When he says that, and this is an FBI agent. This is not like a social worker or a cop or some guy. This is an FBI agent. When he says, I had never heard the term pedophile before.
Right.
Yeah.
So right. I feel like, especially for this story, and then you could even kind of project this backward onto what we heard about the Catholic Church for, you know, now and why it was so quiet before, you know, we're not giving enough credit to the fact that this didn't exist in someone's mind, because a healthy person does not fantasize about children.
Right.
So why would you assume anyone would?
Right.
Right.
Right. It was a totally foreign concept. And I think also in small town Pocatello, you know,
totally.
Where we're really not talking about anything. I grew up in the 70s in a small town in Oregon, and we never, I didn't know the word pedophile. My parents, like, they wanted me to be safe and all that, and they protected me and great, but we never talked about pedophiles. I mean, that's not a word I really even knew until I was well into college, maybe?
Which goes into why a young person wouldn't understand what was happening.
Yeah. Right.
Because they don't have a place to put that. I mean,
right.
Even when anybody's first sexual experiences, there's no real way to categorize those first experiences.
Right.
Like,
right.
At all.
At
other
all.
Than they're the first experiences. And
yeah.
Then that sets the tone, unfortunately, for everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah.
I think that's why so many, like, grisly murders and things happen in small towns. Like, if you're a killer, you have to just think, well, it's the kind of small town where no one locks their doors.
Right.
I'm just going to go there and find somebody to kill.
Yeah, you're a hunter.
And there's a like mm-hmm. a mentality of, well, we're safe. We're not – like that happens in the city.
Yeah.
And no, it doesn't. Like crime happens everywhere.
Everywhere.
And I think yeah. when you're living in that kind of isolated community, you're more susceptible to it because you just – like I lived in Sioux Falls at one point and I walked into a liquor store and there was this couple. They were they had New York plates, I think. And the woman asked the guy if he locked the car door. And she goes, oh, yeah, never mind. We're in Sioux Falls. Sioux Falls at the time had the highest rate of property crime in the nation.
Right.
Like, I wanted to just steal something from the car
just
to
right.
prove a point.
Right.
And, yeah, I think when you get in those smaller locations, you just feel so isolated. And it makes things like this easier to pull off.
Well, a lot easier, too, because you feel so isolated and you feel like you know everyone. And that's the other issue here, right, is that the FBI
totally.
At this point in time was like, stranger danger, stranger danger, stranger danger. And nobody was talking about it's your best friend or your neighbor
right.
and it's somebody that you know.
Yeah.
And these small towns are like, we know everybody. Nobody's a criminal. We're all safe. And so that's where I think the real disconnect then happens. And I honestly, I believe that's the problem still today is nobody ever believes that it's somebody that you know, love, and trust that is going to do this to your children.
Which is why the Michael Jackson thing is so extreme. Because,
yeah.
you know, one of the things, not to plug a different documentary, but,
it's fine.
But literally both of them I've seen like in tandem articles. Like
yeah.
people,
yeah,
it's the same thing. But, you know, I was talking about it with my husband and we were saying how, you know, the power of these, the parents grew up with Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
So the parents thought they knew him, you know, in a way that the kids couldn't even really have appreciated. It's a way that I certainly don't appreciate about Michael Jackson. I've never needed him to be a good guy.
Right.
As far as I knew, he was not a good guy. And I've always thought that. But I feel like you're right. You know, people are attacking naivety. But the reality of it is I think the reaction is so strong because we're all mourning the loss of that together.
Could be.
I think
yeah.
that we want to believe our parents are going to protect us.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair desire from a human being.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the thought that somebody could manipulate the parents on that level, I think subconsciously really rattles people.
And it's almost, I mean, I think Karen says it in our film, you know, it's just, it's too hard to believe that you just don't.
Right.
And you can't see it because it's just too hard. So that's where the denial comes in. And that's where the coping mechanism of just kind of saying, no, 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 it's too bad. It's too bad. It's too bad. I'm just gonna cover my ears and close my eyes and go to sleep.
Well,
yeah.
And then the other thing about it that was fascinating to me that, you know, it's one of those things where I'm watching the documentary and I want to talk about the alien plotline.
Yeah.
We have to talk about that. I mean, we're going to not spoil certain things, but we got to talk about the aliens.
Definitely.
I want to believe that these people don't go to the lengths that Burstall does to brainwash Jan. But then when you watch something like Leaving Neverland, and what these men both have in common is they use what they have at their disposal to completely brainwash these victims for years. That's the other thing, right? Because I think everybody wants to believe, at least like, with the pedophile thing, it's like, it happens once and then they get away and whatever. But it's like, no, unfortunately, when they get a victim, they stay that way for a while.
Right.
Because it's someone they know.
Yeah. And Jan talks about it a lot too. You know, she talks about how they knew the Berchtolds for 2 years before he kidnapped her.
Right.
I mean, she also said, you know, so the brainwashing took 10 seconds, which it's like, well, it did when it finally actually, when that screw was turned, that final screw. But
well,
the brainwashing was over a course of 2 years.
That's like that
and
Tony
beyond.
Robbins thing where he's like, your life doesn't just change in a minute. It's actually
right.
been, I can't believe I just quoted Tony Robbins in this documentary.
Me either.
Conversation. I'm really proud of myself.
It was
and
great.
Twilight.
Thanks.
Tony Robbins and Twilight.
Well,
really?
If we,
hitting all,
yeah,
the, all the important
all the
cultural
highs, yeah.
2019 touchstones.
I feel bad that I didn't bring my vision board. It's all coming, manifesting right here. But the alien thing, can you talk about that? I feel like you could probably explain it better than I could.
Well, so in the film, Jan wakes up in a motorhome after she's been kidnapped the first time and hears these alien voices sort of coming to her through. I mean, as long as we're going here, we might as well bring in Charlie's Angels,
yeah!
right?
So,
I had always imagined this little intercom as the Charlie's Angels squawk box.
Yeah, because
she
wakes up in a Winnebago next to an intercom.
An intercom right. that's got these voices, these alien voices giving her instructions of what to do.
A Winnebago she had never seen before.
Right.
Because
right.
she had been drugged.
Yes. Yeah, and nobody really knew this Winnebago existed. Like, it wasn't, she'd never been in it. The Brobergs had never seen it. So this was a Winnebago that Berchtold had either recently acquired or had been sort of squirreling it away
wow.
somewhere. Yeah. So she wakes up to these voices giving her instructions, and she eventually goes to the front of the motorhome and finds Berchtold there. And it kind of cements him as her companion.
And this hero, really.
Hero. Yeah,
he's
terrified. An adult. She's a little girl. She thinks he tells her that both of them have been kidnapped by aliens and that they're the only two in this situation that know about this. She can't talk to anybody about it because of all these threats.
She'll be vaporized.
She'll be vaporized. No, her dad will be vaporized. Her sister will go blind, which he had known that her sister was terrified of being blind, you know, and he
Ugh.
Said all these things that he'd known about because he'd been around their family,
the
things
hell?
That are the most scary, to use that as ammunition.
I mean, it's just using all of the vulnerability that you share in these experiences with children, you know, because it's like I have friends. We all went to college together. Now they have these babies and
right.
I feel responsible for them, too. You know,
yeah.
like it's like a pack, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't understand. It's a good thing. I don't understand it. But the extent that he goes to brainwash this person. And the thing about it, though, I want to ask you, there's a moment in the documentary where I feel like had this one thing not happened, Jan might have had a shot. And it's the moment where the FBI locates Jan and Berchtold in Mexico,
mm-hmm.
in Mazatlan, which apparently has always just been like the movie Sicario. But
right.
And they're taken in by the Mexican police, and Berchtold bribes a Mexican police officer to bring Jan back down into the cell where he really cements her with this fear. And I
yeah.
feel like had that moment not happened, maybe I'm wrong, but maybe it seems like that's the moment where he just scared the shit out of her.
Yeah. And I mean, imagine this super scary situation that you're in a Mexican prison. I mean,
yeah,
in the 70s, I mean, it's just like to imagine that is like the scariest place for a 12-year-old little girl to be anyway, alone, and then with her hero
right.
off in a different cell. And so I think that situation compounded with him saying, you absolutely cannot talk about it because it's going to get way worse than this.
The
if you
world
do.
Will end.
The world will end.
Right.
Yeah.
And I talked about this when we did our live podcast, but you know, my parents were evangelical rapture people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you hear that and you think like, well, why would a kid believe that? But I remember praying and asking God, you know, if you could just, I understand you got to save the world, but it'd be really great if the rapture could happen after prom. I just wanted
right.
to go to prom.
Right.
That's like where my head was at because I was a child. I didn't know I was a child, but
yeah.
I was a child. Right.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And that's the age where you don't know you're a child.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
I had a paper route when I was a kid, and there was a woman on the route who would, she would save the rubber bands that I put on the papers and then would give them back to me every week.
Aww.
And 1 week I went to collect, like this was when you had to go door to door to collect the money too. And 1 week she didn't give me the rubber bands and was like, the world's ending this week, so I don't need to give you the rubber bands.
Oh, wow.
And I like all that week, I was like, really?
Well, to be fair, Adam, she collected rubber bands.
Right.
And then I showed up the next week like, huh? What happened?
Where's my rubber band,
Where are
lady?
My rubber bands?
I mean, I remember my dad, who, you know, I famously talk about on the show as being really stable. told me he put like flea medication on our cat. And I think I don't think he realized what he said to me, but he said, you know, don't touch the cat because there's poison on the cat and it could kill you.
Right.
And then I absentmindedly pet the cat. And for a week, I thought I was going to die.
Right.
And
right.
My mom was like, are you okay? You're being weird. I'm like, I'm going to die. And my mom was like, why? I'm like, I pet the cat. She's like, I'm very confused. I don't understand.
Right. Yeah. I mean, when you think about, you know, how impressionable we all were at the age of 12, it's like all we know is this little microcosm of what we live in. If our parents say we're going to die because we pet the cat, or that there are aliens, or that the world is going to end because the rubber bands aren't there, you know, then you believe that because we have nothing else to compare it to.
It's such a vulnerable time. You know, my mom passed away when I was 19. My younger brother was 12, and then our younger brother was 10. And it's the 12-year-old that really got hit the most. It's that age.
It's
I don't know what it is about like 12 to 13 where it's got
to
be like a brain thing.
And you're starting to feel like you can think for yourself.
Yeah.
Like you're almost a teen. So you're like, I'm an adult now.
Yeah, you're heading into junior high, which is basically high school.
Yeah. I'd be fascinated because I've often thought about, you know, the kids who are indoctrinated into these gangs, you know, and into all these various different places at the age of around 12, 13, 14, you know, and how that's the age that is targeted because you're the most impressionable at that
time. The Nazis did it. Hitler Youth.
Oh,
yeah.
That was a big component of them staying in power as long as they did,
because
they would get kids early and
I think that's what all youth group is, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's an indoctrination tool.
Yeah.
I don't know why it didn't work on me. It did for a while, but I think I just had too much
curiosity?
Angela's ass.
Wait, you were in the Hitler Youth?
Yeah, no. Oh, yeah. I've never brought this up. Whoops. Not anymore. I figured, no, that is not accurate. Jesus. Anyway, that won't come back to bite. I guess I can't run for president now.
Right.
Not during World War II. Anyway.
No. So he manages to brainwash her in this. How long were they gone the first stint?
3 months.
3 months. I mean, also just statistically speaking.
Is that right?
No, the first
three weeks.
But it doesn't matter. Because
there was a shorter one and a longer.
The shorter one was the first one. Sorry, I missed
three
misspoke
weeks.
There.
Though the statistics of a child being returned after being kidnapped after 3 weeks are like no one does. Like you don't get your kid back typically at that point.
Right.
So it's a miracle.
Yeah,
that they get their child back.
Yeah,
like it's a miracle now.
Yeah,
and then the boom is lowered.
Yeah.
They're blackmailed, which is the thing I don't want to talk about how it happens, but the parents are blackmailed because it's like, if you take that away from them.
I know.
Yeah.
I told my husband that, like, I'm not a sports person, but this documentary made me sound like one because of how much I was yelling at the TV.
Yeah.
I was like, what? Like, no!
Oh, yeah.
You know? But she gets taken again.
Yeah.
He's let back into the family again. So just even beyond the blackmail effort, he's still let back into the family on some level.
Yeah. And this is where I think faith really comes into play a lot because
I completely agree with you.
Yeah. Because I think so much of what the Brobergs were thinking was, A, he's just kind of sick. He took our daughter, but there's something wrong with him and we can help him.
Something that we don't have context for at all.
At all. At all.
We don't know how dark this really is.
No.
Right.
No. So I think that's so much a part of it. And the church let him back in. They let him back in with the idea that we can help this man get better. And if he spends more time around us, our family, which we love him, we're good people, we can help him be a better person.
You're so right about this, because what they teach you in the LDS community and Christian communities is, you know, Jesus asks his disciples, how will they know us? And he says, by our love.
Right.
So they think that that's what works.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you get it.
Yeah.
But it's like...
And it would be wonderful.
Wouldn't that be great?
Wouldn't it be great?
Well, I actually believe for most people that's... true, it's just that comes with like a million qualifiers. But with child predators, I don't believe that's true.
Right. It's just such a hard thing because I think that faith also saved the Brobergs. I think it kept them
totally
together. But it's also what opened the door to the vampire.
I feel like ultimately your documentary is a conversation about how complicated our inner negotiations about the concept of forgiveness are.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah.
Because forgiveness is how all of this happens, including the good stuff.
Exactly.
There's I mean, this will kind of be a spoiler, but...
Yeah, it's whatever.
It's okay.
Not really, but there's a... I think the most shocking moment to me is after he's already kidnapped their kid, the mom has an affair with him.
Yeah.
Like, talk about letting the guy back in. My God.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's a long affair.
It's 8 months.
Eight months.
It's like 11 encounters over 8 months.
Yeah.
I may have watched a documentary 8 or 9
Which,
times.
Yeah. That blew my mind.
It's like, a really interesting thing to me because, you know, when he'd planted those seeds, you know, he'd sort of started this whole flirtation and sort of some necking and things before the first kidnapping. And so when that affair sort of continues after the first kidnapping, and this is interesting too, because I think in Marianne's mind, she was like, well, if he's attracted to me, I mean, that, I don't even think she was thinking he can't be attracted to my little girl. I think it was nowhere in her brain that that could even be.
Well, and also they had Jan examined.
Right.
And by all accounts, her hymen hadn't been broken yet.
Right.
Which, you know, there's that. The reason for that is elucidated prior to what you find out. But again, in the context of that time, well, if a doctor is telling you that she hasn't been assaulted and my daughter is telling me that nothing happened.
Right.
Right. And that's the other issue, a much greater issue that goes to, you know, the Michael Jackson documentary, RJ Kelly, all of these things are these sort of positions of power. And in my mind, it's these patriarchal institutions that say, we wield all power, churches, listen to us because you're supposed to listen to us. And everybody else says, oh, we'll listen to them because we're supposed to listen to them. And that's what happened, I think, with a doctor saying, and, you know, a doctor who couldn't possibly think that there was any other type of abuse that could have happened except for penetration like that just blows my mind, too. But
well, he just didn't have fun in college, obviously. Right. I mean, honestly, the thing that comes to mind, too, when I think about her, Jan's mother, Marianne, is which, and I think that this is a fair thing to wonder about, although there is not going to, it's a black box. How lonely do you have to be? Because even if, like, even if we're talking about just the bare facts that he abducted her daughter.
Right.
Like,
right.
Because, you know, it's like I have a son and, you know, if he's at the grocery store too long with someone that isn't myself or my husband, I hate that person.
Right.
For at least that time. Like,
yeah.
I want to kill them until my baby's back in my arms.
Yeah.
So she does lose me with this affair based on that alone.
I know.
And I mean, again, I am no one, but.
But you represent how a lot of people feel.
But I do question the power of loneliness.
Yeah.
Because I think that how these people work is, and you know, you see this in your documentary and in all of the stories that have come out of what happened with the Catholic Church, happening, what is happening with the Catholic Church and, you know, all these other places, is they identify lonely people that have never been told that they're special.
Right, right.
And
yeah.
look at what social media has capitalized on with that.
Right.
Just that.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's just, that thing has preyed on us in that way. So if a person who you respect and who you perceive as everyone else loving is telling you that you're special, you're going to save the world.
Right.
You. And then, or this mother who, I don't know what was going on between her and her husband. It doesn't seem like a lot because she was so easily taken in by the charms of a man in a trailer.
Right.
For God's sakes, woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, too, you know, her husband, Bob, had his own business. He had his flower shop. So he was there all the time. She was stuck at home with the kids, not getting sort of a real husband at home helping her. So I agree with you completely. Like, what does loneliness do to you? And how do you have to kind of, you know, just check in with your partner and make sure you're not getting there, you know, to this completely lonely, desolate state.
Because we all want to believe that we can't be that desperate. But
yeah,
I think that's the first step towards ruination, is assuming that you can't make these colossal mistakes.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's how people get behind the car drunk, behind the wheel of a car drunk.
Like, because they never believe they're going to get in a crash.
I'm fine.
Right. Right.
That's how it all happens.
Yeah. And I look back to, you know, sort of how different my feelings of love are now with my husband, because we've been married for 10 years and it's changed completely.
Yeah.
And I say, you know, I'm a little bit like, we'll never feel the same way that we did about each other as we did in that first 2 years of dating ever. Never going to be this like crazy, desperate, maniacal sort of love that we felt. It's transitioned into something deeper and meaningful, and I love him to bits, but that sort of crazy love, right, is never going to be there with us again. And so with Marianne, I think she was starting to feel that. And I don't actually know if it was this crazy love, because she and Bob, when they first were dating, he was away on a mission and they were dating through these letters. And so I'm not sure that sort of feeling of crazy love was there with her with Bob. And so maybe this was the first time she felt it.
I never really got a hot and heavy vibe from the two of them. Anyway, I mean, and that's not really for me to say, but I think it's important, because it's like, you know, like my parents, for example, stayed married because the church told them to stay married. And so there's all of that going on, too.
Yeah.
You know, like
for sure.
The divorce doesn't cross your mind. Like none of that.
It's not an option.
It's not an option.
Right.
So one of the things that I have been pondering over, especially now that I'm seeing all the reactions and looking at my own reactions, I feel like people approach content now like, okay, well, now that I know this, I have to do something about it. I have to have an opinion about it. I have to decide something about this. But I feel like your documentary is not asking anyone to do that. And if anything, it shows what the one person that had any agency in it could really do about it, which is Jan. She did the two things that would be hard for anyone to do, which is she forgave her family.
Yeah.
And she became an activist.
Right.
That's who we need to do something about this. So
right.
Do you think people are having a complicated reaction about it because they feel they need to put this somewhere?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that when people watch it, their reactions are so big because it's just so sort of unbelievable what we're experiencing. And I actually feel like they're sort of thrust into this place of wanting to talk to somebody about it. And I, for one, feel like that's a really good place to be, because we aren't talking about it. And if this film sort of thrusts you onto Twitter, even if they're hate tweets that you're throwing out there, or, you know, you feel bad for the parents. And even now, I think people maybe don't feel like they can feel bad for the parents because they'll get attacked on social media. But our whole hope with this was to really start the conversation. And even though the conversation is pretty sort of volatile right now, it started, and I do feel like people are talking about it. And for that, I kind of think maybe we were trying to do that. We were trying to incite some kind of a response to start this so that we can continue it, so that Jan really can continue it.
Right.
Well, what kind of person watches this and doesn't feel something? You know, I mean.
I know.
That's kind of a hard one. It'd be
I think there's been one. There's been one tweet out there that was like.
One thing.
That said. Yeah, it wasn't as shocking as I thought it was going to be. And I was like, I liked it. I was like,
well, also, like, can someone check on that person?
I know.
Are they okay? What was their childhood like?
Yeah.
Maybe they're in like a Twilight situation.
Oh, maybe. Maybe just big Twilight fans.
Right.
Yeah, 50 Shades of Grey. This is how it's supposed to work.
So you're not saying he's literally a vampire. Well, I'm out.
I know.
This is some bullshit. Yeah. No eternal life? Fuck this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, my other question. I swear to God, I'll stop at some point. But were you scared to release this? Like, as an artist, this is a heck of a debut.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I was scared. I think I had a lot of conversations with myself and with my husband and just saying, is this a story that should be out there? Is this exploitive in any way? Is this doing something it shouldn't be doing? Should the story even be told? And every time, you know, we'd sort of sit there and talk about it, it really came back to the fact that, yeah, it should be told. And Jan wants to talk about it. And her family wants to talk about it. And I, you know, her parents, I think they had an idea about the backlash that was going to happen. Jan certainly had an idea. Her sister certainly had an idea about the backlash that was going to happen. And they still went forward and told the story anyway. So the fact that, I mean, I guess it goes back to people talking about it and trying to just ease some of the shame. Because I even know, you know, the more Jan talks about it, the easier it is for her to talk about these things. And the more any of us talk about anything hard to talk about, the more we do it, the easier it becomes. The more people hear it, the easier it is for them to tell their stories. And so there were certainly those moments where I questioned whether this film would do any good. And I can only hope that it does.
I like a lot of things about it, but that's one of the things I like about it. I do feel like a lot of true crime documentaries are a little exploitative. Especially with a lot of the newer shows where it's just like crimes of opportunity. Like, we know how that happens.
Right.
Like, you're just showing me murders for my entertainment. Right.
Yeah, Adam and I have to like really sift through topics because it's like, do we really need to talk about this? Like,
but with this, there's absolutely something to be learned in how this happens. And because it's so easy to be on the outside and go, well, as a parent, I would never let that happen. And maybe you would. You don't know. You know, watching a documentary like this explains that. It explains, at least in that case, it explains how it happened. And that speaks to a broader psychology behind the people who do this.
Yeah. The question I really have is, do people watch it and feel so sort of separated from it, going, this could never happen to me, that all of their ability to kind of take it in and listen and self-reflect, does that just go away? Or does it sit with them and then like somewhere down the road do they go, remember that when I said this was never going to happen to me? It's happening to me. Maybe I can change it. And that's my big question. Like, is it so kind of like hit you in the face that people just say, nope, I'm not listening. I'm turning it off. I'm putting the blinders on. And that's what's going to be sort of interesting, I think, moving forward and as the film is out there for a while.
I think it's going to do both. I mean, I know that in the world of true crime, especially amongst podcasters and, you know, some of the other industry conversations I've had, is the overall sense is that there was an anxiety at the beginning of this kind of explosion in the genre of like, are we assholes?
Right.
Are we?
Yeah.
And in some cases, yeah. But no more than Dr. Phil is an asshole, in my opinion.
Right.
And in some cases, I think he can be a lot worse, actually. But or like Maury Povich, or, you know, which is a person that continues a stereotype about the African-American community literally every day.
Right.
Right.
So thanks to that. But I think that the fact that this is now in the cultural consciousness is the most important thing.
Mm, yeah.
Because I come back to this, the elaborate nature of what this person did to victimize this entire family was real. And people need to know that that's possible, because otherwise, you know, when you're in it and you're being gaslighted by the whole thing, you just think to yourself, like, this is crazy. You know, it's like when you're at work and, you know, you've been freelancing for a long time.
Yeah.
Just got laid off from an office job, you know, it's like when you're working with these people and they're just being shitty to you, and you know they're being shitty to you, but then you try to talk about it in HR and they're like, Caitlin, put yourself in my shoes. What exactly am I supposed to do about a snotty email, which could be read anyway? That's the world you're living in.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's your life.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think it came out at a good time, because not just Leaving Neverland, but also the R. Kelly documentary just happened. And
it's like when Volcano and Dante's Peak came out in the same year.
Exactly. It is exactly like that.
I feel like it's explosive.
Yeah. It's,
I'm here all week.
Yeah.
Because with the R. Kelly and Michael Jackson thing, there's a power component in any case like this. But with that, there's fame too. So you can watch either of those and go, well, my kid's never going to be in the same room with Michael Jackson, so I'm fine. And then you watch this documentary, and that's not Michael Jackson pulling off these crimes. It's just a regular dude.
Right.
Who got, like, I had a family friend when I was a kid who was just around all the time, and he weirded me the fuck out.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah, that's
that
enough.
Guy could have been this guy. Like,
he probably might have been.
He might have been. Yeah.
I feel like our instincts are generally right about people, because, I mean, it sounds like a terrible thing to say. Like, hate is not the same thing as an instinct, by the way. But anyway.
One thing he did, I won't even say his name. I always suspected he was in the CIA or something. He was really weird.
Oh, the weird guy.
But one time, my sister, for some reason, was using the bathroom with the door open. She was like 8 or something. And he walks in.
Nope.
And sees her and just stops and goes, oh my God, Betsy, you're getting so big.
Ew!
And we were all just like, isn't that weird? And that was the end of it.
Well, I think we can confirm.
That's weird.
That's weird.
And looking back, it's like, why was that dude around our house?
Right.
It's nuts.
Yeah,
right.
I worked for a guy. One of my ex-coworkers was like just like a robot beautiful person, like just the kind of beautiful person where sometimes you kind of want to touch their face. You're like, fuck
yeah,
that person.
Yeah.
And one of the guys that was running the company walked past her and he's, I'm going to change her name. And he's like, Jessica, are you behaving? And I'm like, did that? What the fuck just happened? What? You know, I felt like Rosie O'Donnell in Sleepless in Seattle. You know, like, I know I'm the co-star right now, but that's not okay. I think the hardest part about something like this is that we have to start talking about human worth in a way that makes us very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because we're in this time where it's like, well, we can't talk about that because then some people are worth more than others. And it's like, no, that's not the conversation we're having. We're having a conversation about like how forgiveness functions in conjunction with how we make people worth things and not worth, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, because if we look at a story like this and say, well, these people are worthless and that's gross and what a ride, and then we walk away, then we don't learn anything.
Right. Right.
But the truth of the matter is the only person that gets to say how she feels about this is Jan. Mm-hmm. And Jan forgave her family.
Right.
So we can have our opinions about it. But the reality, the world we're living in, is the person that was most victimized and most harmed has decided to handle it this way.
Right.
And we don't get to,
yeah,
we don't get to weigh in on that.
Harassing her family on social media is not helping.
No,
like no matter what your opinion is, it's not.
No,
you're not doing anyone in that story any good.
Yeah, and just because I look at somebody who's made a mistake doesn't, and I don't agree with them does not mean that as a parent they are in a net negative. It does not make me a good parent.
Right. And it, also, it's like, you're against kids being molested? Congratulations.
Yes,
everyone
right.
is.
Right.
We hope that's your stance.
Yeah. I was joking about when I was in that podcast festival in Portland. One of the tour guides was so sweet. And she's like, I think you're great. I think you should run for president. I'm like, well, my platform is going to be I'm going to execute child rapists. that's what I'm going to do. And she's like, what? I'm like, think about it.
Right.
There's my platform. There I am at the great debate. You can argue with me if you want.
Right.
But I'm going to win.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
a slam dunk.
And yet, we don't like having these conversations.
We hate having these conversations.
Right.
And I think a lot of it, too, is because we have to realize kind of our own role in them.
Totally.
Yeah. And we're just not willing to turn the mirror on ourselves. Like even I'm still kind of flabbergasted about all of the responses on social media. It's about the parents, not the pedophile.
Always.
Always.
Yeah. Always about the victim in that
way. I would argue he's the real criminal here.
What? Really? You're going out on
Adam,
a limb there.
Could you not be an
can
asshole
we pause
for once in your life?
Can we pause so I can tweet that, please?
Yeah, sure. As Oprah would say, a tweetable moment. Well, I actually, now that you said that, this is interesting because when it comes to serial killers, it's the serial killer that gets all of the accolade.
Right.
I mean, there's no other word for it, honestly.
Right.
The fame,
right.
Or whatever.
Yes, yes.
But when it comes to people who've been victimized sexually, it's the opposite.
Yeah, yeah.
Why is that?
Oh.
How weird. I had never really put that together until just now.
Well, most serial killers are men and most victims are women.
Oh.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, you had to make it about that, did you?
Sorry.
Okay, Sky.
But
well,
I think there's something.
No, I think you're probably right.
I mean, I think there's something to be said about that. And I think that serial killers, you know, I think it's a pretty severe line in the sand. Like there's no questioning what their motives were, you
right.
know? And I think that's.
Well, I'm just thinking in my head.
He's an activist serial killer.
But what's funny, here's what's funny about it. It's like, if you accuse somebody of being a child molester, there's this unspoken thing where we all realize like, okay, if we all say this guy's a child
right.
molester, he's not coming back from this.
Right.
Has literally everyone been pulled? Meanwhile, OJ Simpson, I think, is working on a reality show.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think there's just like it just touches on like everyone understands that there's nothing more sacred than a child. Like no one is going to
argue
with that.
Right.
But to accuse someone of violating that trust seems like the sonic boom that people are all afraid to kind of like activate about anybody.
Yeah. But nobody. I mean, the cover-ups. I mean, that's the thing is it's like nobody is covering up serial killers.
No.
Nobody's covering that up, but everybody's
and
covering up.
And they're still church members.
Yes.
They're still, John Wayne Gacy is the perfect example
right.
of this.
Right.
But I mean, again, though, like, we could go on a much deeper dive, but, like, if we're talking about men who sexually abuse women in the context of church, it's so much easier for a man with a sex addiction and alcoholism to come forward and be this, like, sad, you know, redemption story. However, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a recovering porn star in any church because of the way women are treated.
Right. Right.
Because of the way our sexuality has been played out.
Right.
So
right.
That's a whole other beeswax situation.
But it's a big question because it's like, so it's great. Okay, this movie is out there. Finding Neverland is out there. And will it make any difference? Are these films going to sort of help us sort of right the ship in any way to have people sort of open their eyes a little bit more to their own actions, to other people's actions, and not have these massive, massive cover-ups?
I think it will because of how well done it is. Because, well and I say that because it's, as somebody who covered The Keepers, like what we do on White Wine True Crime is we cover stuff episode by episode sometimes.
Right, right.
That documentary is much harder to watch than you. First of all, it's 6 hours, so there's
I know.
Which actually, did you guys consider making like a longer Netflix-y series version?
Yeah, we had considered it at some point.
Because I'm sure you could have.
We could have.
I'm glad you didn't.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I know. I am too a little bit. But it's been interesting lately because people are like, we want a follow-up. We want, you know, we want more. We want more.
Well, you
want
to see Catherine Zellner like tweeting? Like, why?
I know, yeah. And then I kind of go, well, it would be interesting because I think what people want is a little bit more of it unpacked. You know, they want to know a little bit more about the faith element.
I don't think you're ever going to satisfy people with it, though. And
it's
I
true,
think you're
because,
such a great filmmaker and you should just go do just my unsolicited career advice from an unemployed woman with a Honda Accord from 2010.
My kind of woman.
I just think you know how to capture shit. And that's a bigger, that's more important. You know, the Staircase is a perfect example of like, you know, there's all this mystery around it. They kept coming out with more. And by the end, everyone's like, okay, so this is still Michael Peterson's still
it's a very
weird.
Sensitive topic for me.
I know it is. The owl theory.
Owls attack people sometimes. I'm sorry.
I know, man. And I love you for who you are and your owl tendencies. Anyway.
Owls did it. Owls did it.
But back, I mean, The Keepers, I don't think it was done well, frankly. I don't think they did justice to, like, when it got to the point where Maskell dies, it was like, oh, and they found out Maskell's dead, and then they moved on. I'm like, oh, excuse me, the whole point of the documentary, we're dropping? And then I just sat through 3 hours of basically deposition of women being sexually abused, and I don't know how helpful that part was.
Right, right, yeah.
It was literally like a Catholic sense of penance.
Right.
It's just like, whoa, why are you putting me? Whoa. Hey.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there is something to say about, you know, storytelling and delivering the story and having it be concise and having it be something that I think encourages people to talk about it. I mean, there are plenty of people talking about The Keepers, I guess. But I do feel like there is something about the sort of tightness and the questions left unanswered in Abducted in Plain Sight that probably could never be answered, or at least at this point in time. I mean, maybe, you know, fast forward 50 years or something, maybe we could answer more questions then. But I think there's something about that really encourages people to think.
What about Burchtel fascinated you?
Okay, this is going to be
I know this is like a really shitty question to ask, but it's kind of the most important one, I think.
Yeah, so this is interesting because, and this is what I think is most fascinating about serial manipulators. They don't really lie. And that was really fascinating to me. Like, they take the truth and they just kind of twist it. And so they don't have to keep track of things all that much because they're never really lying. They don't have to keep
like
track
a murderer.
Of the lies. Like a murderer. Yeah.
They have to lie at a certain point.
Exactly. I didn't do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Okay.
What, that rag? Yeah. No. I was making a stake.
But with everything, you know, with everything that we got from him, which was, you know, it was some audio recordings and it was some documents and all of these things. But I was like, he's never really flat out lied. He's talked about something in a way that sort of deflected or that sent me on a different path. But he was pretty truthful the whole time. And that's what was really fascinating.
Right, like,
to
I
me.
Had her for, you're right. She was with me.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't talk about He did not talk about molesting her. He did not talk about abusing her. But he said, yes, we were together. We got married. All of this stuff. That was real. And in this, we don't go into it much in the documentary, but he had written this kind of manifesto, I'll call it, and had sent a few pages of that to the Brobergs in the early 2000s. And we always tried to track this down, right? But it was kind of a story about his and Jan's perfect time in Mexico together. And reading these pages, you were just like, holy cow. And that's another thing where you were like, he was in love with Jan.
Yeah.
And that's also really fascinating to me. Like, it's not, yes, it's awful, it's devious, it's all of those things, but there is that crazy love thing behind it too.
Well, she talks about it too. She talks about never having felt
that way,
love
that way.
Like that ever.
Yeah, ever.
Ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
Well, and in
it's
another,
a heavy document.
Yeah.
It's something that I want to encourage everybody, believe it or not, despite the fact we've been talking for as long as we have, there is a lot more that we didn't touch on because I want you to enjoy the documentary. I don't want to spoil it. I have lots of shows. So what are you... So, Sky, tell us, what's next for you?
It's a very good question. I think... Look, I love diving into the human condition, and I love looking at the very complex ways that people deal with things and deal with trauma or deal with success or deal with anything. Yeah. And those are the stories that I'm the most interested in telling. I love true crime, but I'm not a what do you call a murdernario?
A murderino.
Murderino.
Yeah. Close enough.
Yeah.
You made it more Italian.
Thank you. I'm not a murderino necessarily. You know, right. it's not the murders or the Zodiac killer or those kind of things.
Sure.
It really is a more kind of a homegrown kind of crimes and crimes that happen next door and how they happen. And so look, I don't know, like, is a follow-up to Abducted in Plain Sight on the books? I don't know yet.
Sure.
I think it could be interesting, but I kind of think of it more as like some of the themes that we delved into and more like a Baz Luhrmann kind of trilogy of Strictly Ballroom, Romeo and Juliet.
So we're talking
Rouge.
Like a whole like Paradise Lost thing with you.
Possibly. So,
okay.
Possibly.
Right,
you know,
great.
I mean, look, there are a lot of options and there are a lot of dark topics to delve into. And there's a lot of lightness, too. And I think sort of looking at that human condition is something that's infinitely fascinating to me. So and I think really, you know, thinking about projects with very much women's stories involved is also something that I'm very dedicated to.
Thank you. We like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We like that. Well, because so many serial killer stories are technically women's stories and they're never.
Sorry,
never.
I need to step out to tweet something else.
Oh, God. He really, I don't even know how we've lasted this long.
I know.
Like today.
Well, he's kind of cute.
I agree.
Right?
Adam's adorable. He's adorable. My guy. Well, how can people find you?
Oh, so yeah. So I've got two websites, really. Sky at Top Knot Films. Top Knot Films is my production company along with my husband. And Sky at skyborgman.com. And that has more of my director of photography work on it. But yeah, reach out to me and follow the work that I do. I'll keep everybody posted for sure.
Good. Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
This was amazing. I mean, the conversations on this podcast have been really, really incredible. Thank you.
Oh,
thank you for doing it.
Makes me feel so good.
Yes.
I'm never going to get over this. Hey, Adam.
Hey.
If people want to talk to you, how the hell does that happen?
You can find me on Twitter, all the social medias.
Wait.
At Adam Todd Brown.
The Twitter. I have been underestimating you.
Where I post my controversial opinions.
Yeah, about
how adults shouldn't molest kids.
Well, that old chestnut. But also, you seem to think, and we're going to argue
no, it's
about
just
this
that.
Later.
It's very unsettling. It's almost...
It is like 12 tweets in a row.
Yeah, it's weird.
That is a weird thing to watch.
No, follow me on Twitter at Adam Todd Brown. And subscribe on Patreon, patreon.com/unpops.
Toss us a little cash.
Please.
You can find me on Twitter at Bossy Matilda, because I clearly started my account in college and had no idea where all that was going. And you can find White Wine True Crime at WWT Crime. And you can find White Wine True Crime on Instagram at WWT Crime. And you can find me on Instagram.
Oh, and Pretty Scary. At Pretty Scary Boo.
Oh, yeah. We have a Twitter account for Pretty Scary.
We'll start
scary.
Using it soon.
God damn it.
I need to throw my Twitter account
yes,
in, too.
Yes, you do.
Because I need to be better at Twitter, and
okay.
I'm really trying hard.
Well, our fans will help.
Thank you. It's just
sorry
my name.
Advance.
It's Sky Borgman.
Oh,
it's
see,
nothing
that's,
exciting, but
again,
it's easy to find.
Bossy Matilda,
I know.
Like a stripper, so it's fine.
Well, that's your real name.
Well, yeah. We'll just tell everybody. Now I'm going to go back and change my LinkedIn profile again. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for coming on our show, Sky.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Thank you for doing it.
All right.
Say goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody. Bye. Bye.